today. Okay, we all know veganism is better for the planet. But what if I told you it makes you better in bed? Got you now. And a bombshell exclusive about the hacking of Jeff Bezos's phone.
I decided to go vegan yesterday, and it hasn't gone that well so far.
Oh, what happened?
I had a packet of cheese and onion crisps.
Easy mistake, yeah.
And then my big mistake, which I only realised when I woke up this morning, was that I suddenly remembered I ate two prawns.
Oh, well, you know, you're getting there, I guess.
I'm back on it today. I've only had a banana and tea with oat milk, so I reckon I'm safer today.
But you know, being vegan doesn't mean you should be malnourished, right? So you have to eat.
Marco Springman initially trained as a physicist, but a personal interest in diet led to a change of direction. He's now an Oxford University academic researching what food is best for your body and the planet. Guess what? Veganism scores very well. And it's quite the rage. Normally the start of year is all about dry January, but in 2020, there's more chat about Veganuary. And it goes beyond New Year's resolutions. The number of vegans in Britain has quadrupled in 5 years to 600,000, according to the Vegan Society. And producers know it.
Hell, it even bleeds like a medium-rare burger. But this patty is actually all plant.
Do you have any vegan sausage rolls?
No, we're sold out.
Do you have any vegan sausage rolls?
I can't believe Greggs have sold out of the vegan sausage roll.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, should we all go vegan?
So listen, you grew up in Germany. And when I think Germany, I think schnitzels, sausages. I mean, what were your favourite things to eat as a child?
Yeah, sausages, really. I mean, I think my mom tried to cook what could probably be described as Mediterranean fusion. So she thought she cooked Mediterranean, but it was still sort of a German variety.
What's that? Sausages and tomatoes.
Yes, something like that. Well, actually, my favorite dish used to be tortellini it was sort of filled with ham, right? In a curry cream sauce.
That sounds more like a green Asian-Italian mix.
Yeah, it was really good, actually. I think I can't remember any day where I didn't have any meat. So in that sense, it was traditionally German.
When did you first become curious about veganism?
It was really by chance. At that time, I was living in the US and I just noticed that on the milk, for example, on some milks, they would write not treated with hormones, which meant all the other milks were. And the meat, you couldn't even check what that was treated with. So just from a precautionary perspective, even without knowing about the health implications, I decided to go vegetarian because I felt I couldn't control what was in the meat. And then a year later or so, I just drove back from uni at the time and I listened to the radio. And there was an interview of a biochemist on who had just written a popular science book about diets and the association with health impacts. And up to then, I never really had thought all that much about the implications of my diet. And then hearing that it actually has quite a strong association with chronic diseases like cancer and heart disease was really quite startling for me. So I remember saying to my partner at the time, I think we have to go vegan.
Did you find it hard at first?
No, not at all. I mean, my thought was really, okay, if I can reduce my risk of getting some chronic nasty cancer or a heart disease, and in my family there had been cases of cancer, which I saw the effects of, thought if I could reduce the risk by 20-30% and still have a good diet and be even healthier, you know, why wouldn't I do that?
It doesn't sound to me like a big driver for you was the fact that animals were being killed. Well, I finally came to the realization about a year ago that I really didn't like the idea of animals being killed. And that was certainly one of perhaps three drivers for me. I mean, did that matter to you at all?
Yeah, to be honest, not. I mean, now I identify with that a little bit more and I find it surely appalling how animals are slaughtered en masse for producing meat. But back then, I was not really so much attuned to that. And I always thought you need, in a way, a really egoistic reason to change your diet. If it doesn't do something for you, and if you don't enjoy it, you don't stick with it.
What made you make that second jump from vegetarian to vegan?
Well, so those studies that I had looked at the time, they clearly associated any animal product with increased risk in chronic diseases. Now that I work on it, I see it a little bit more differentiated. So in most big observational studies, we see that milk, at least in Western populations, is a fairly neutral food. So it doesn't increase much your risk, but it doesn't decrease your risk by much either. So it's probably okay if you have some, but the problem with milk and with poultry is it takes up lots of stuff in your diet that you could fill with more healthy foods. So if you replaced milk by, let's say, legumes like lentils, beans, or by nuts and seeds, by fruits and vegetables, any of those things, that would always be better.
But it's not a choice between a glass of milk or a bowl of nuts, is it?
Well, there is nut milk, right? There's cashew milk, almond milk, there's soybean milk, right? So in a way, it's that choice.
Oh, so this oat milk that we are currently drinking in our tea is healthier for me?
Yeah, absolutely.
In what way? What's it doing to me?
So it has more fiber. Fiber is most likely causally related to reductions in chronic disease risk. That's the main bit.
I mean, how robust is the science?
Well, the science seems to be fairly clear when we look at the evidence on a food group level. So there we know if we eat more fruits and vegetables, that's generally good for our health, reduces the risk of many chronic diseases. We also know with quite some certainty that if we increase our intake of red and processed meat, that is generally bad for our health and increases our risk for many chronic diseases. And lots of other things are sort of in the middle. But if we combine them all together, then we find that if we analyze complete diets, that a vegan diet is generally either the healthiest or among the healthiest.
What are the others that are among it?
So the pescatarian diets seem to be fairly healthy as well.
That's what I was until yesterday. Maybe I should go back to that.
So not so bad for sure. Depending on what you look at, on the theoretical level, most of the time, a well-composed, completely plant-based diet would still be a little bit preferable to a pescatarian diet. But yeah, already a pescatarian diet is also pretty good.
Can I just drill into this? Because a lot of people I know at the moment have gone absolutely wild about this documentary, The Game Changers.
But the idea that food could be the secret weapon, I had to find out more.
And I was very interested when you said that there has to be some sort of selfish reason why people do things, because we will talk about the environmental benefits of being vegan.
In muscles and joints.
But what the Game Changers does is it puts it entirely on the health benefit.
Plant-based protein, you're getting protein that's packaged with antioxidants, phytochemicals, minerals, and vitamins that are going to reduce inflammation.
And what it means for you. In fact, it suggests that elite athletes should be vegan, perhaps as a way of improving their performance.
The blood test with the Miami Dolphins measured how a single meal could affect blood flow throughout the entire body.
It also has an interesting experiment in which they attach machines to men's private parts.
Now, you're going to be putting this device on yourself. One ring goes on the base of the penis.
Overnight, and the other following both a vegan and a meat diet, and show that
the more meat men eat, the more quickly they lose their manly manhood.
Function in that area seems to be higher when you've not eaten meat.
Interesting.
Has your research shown you that as well?
You mean my personal research? I feel fine, that's what I can say.
But if there was one thing that I was left unsure about, as someone who's already given up meat and who quite likes fish, I couldn't tell for sure what the benefits were of going the extra mile, of giving up eggs, of giving up milk, of giving up cheese and butter.
Sure.
What does your research suggest on that?
So many of those things that are still in there in a, for example, pescatarian or vegetarian diet, they're not like super strongly associated on the health bit. So you have a bit reduction in your risk, but you have a much greater reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and other environmental impacts.
Let's come to that in a minute. Just before we do, I want to ask you one more thing on health. This week I had an appointment with a doctor and they said, you need iron. And I said, oh, but I'm going to go vegan this week. And they said, really, I wouldn't recommend you going vegan at the moment. I mean, are there concerns about potential downsides like anemia or a calcium deficiency?
What comes up in our nutrition analysis that we also regularly do when we run different dietary scenarios in our studies is that, yes, calcium might be and sometimes a bit low in a vegan diet. B vitamins like B12 might be low. So that would surely be good to supplement. Iron is usually okay in our analyses. But what I would say is if you feel a little bit different, really make a blood test. I should not bang on about what doctors recommend here, but very often doctors actually don't have lots of education on the connection between diet and health.
And is there an argument that, of course, you can have a nutritionally balanced diet if you're vegan, but perhaps it's more difficult to achieve that than if you are eating red meat every day, for example?
I don't think that's true. If you just combine different colored vegetables, for example, the color usually indicate different concentrations of vitamins and minerals. And if you have more than five a day, then it's really hard to be actually deficient in any vitamins. And if you have whole grains, then you get awful lot of minerals through those whole grains. So it's really not hard if you have a well-composed diet.
I love this advice on colors. So what should I do? Like red pepper, orange carrot, green peas.
Yeah, that's good. So we usually group vegetables in three groups. So green leafy, they're very important. They have usually lots of iron, for example. Then we look at orange fleshed vegetables, so sweet potato, but also tomatoes. There are different vitamins in there that are beneficial and phytochemicals. And then sort of we mush all others together. And with those three groups, you can nicely show that there are very different concentrations in there.
When you first went back to Germany to see your family, how did they take the news that you'd gone vegan?
I was always the skinny person. So when I changed my diet, my parents first thought I'll gonna die.
That's what my parents were a bit like as well. So the first, my dad said, don't be so extreme.
Yeah, they literally didn't know what I would eat, right? So the first winter I came home for Christmas, I just cooked for them for a couple of days. And they came visit me in the US when I moved back. And I also cooked for them for a week. And they saw that what I ate was actually nice.
So you've told me about how your interest in veganism has now become a kind of central part of your job. You've talked about the research you've done on health. But clearly, there's another huge issue that we've been talking about, especially over the last year, and that's the impact on the environment and on sustainability. Tell me about what research you do in that area.
So we look at both what are the changes in emissions that might be associated with dietary changes and how that impacts climate change or our chance of avoiding dangerous levels of climate change in general. If you look at consumption responsibilities, you suddenly see the food system pop up as a significant source of greenhouse gas emissions. So now estimates are such that the food system is responsible for up to a third of all greenhouse gas emissions. So it's really a major driver of climate change.
And I mean, I joke with my kids that that's because cows fart, but can you just explain to me what it is about the kind of food production process that leads to emissions?
So there are several sources of greenhouse gas emissions when we look at the food system. One is you need to fertilize fields in order to grow crops. Much of those crops then end up as feed for animals. For example, a cow can need up to 50 kilograms of feed to put on 1 kilogram of body weight. And whilst fertilizing, a very potent greenhouse gas called nitrous oxide is released. So that is one source. Then in order to grow some of the feed, sometimes some forest will have been cleared.
The rich greens of the most vibrant habitat on Earth.
That then is related to release of carbon dioxide.
The billions of trees store so much carbon, they help to slow down global warming.
A third source is the direct emissions of ruminant animals like cows and sheep. So cows, they don't really fart so much, they burp a lot. And while digesting the feed, they produce a potent greenhouse gas called methane. The greenhouse gas emissions of 1 kilogram of beef is about 100 times as much as those of legumes like beans and lentils.
And where do the other things fit on that scale?
Okay, so you first have beef and lamb, then 10 times less you have other meats like poultry and pork, then a bit lower you have milk and eggs, and then lower still you have most of the plant-based foods.
There are some vegan options that have had a bit of stick in terms of the environment. Is that reasonable?
Yes and no. Lots of people are concerned about the water use of almonds, specifically in California. And sure enough, there are too many almonds properly produced in California, and they lead to water depletion there. But almond milk still needs only half of the water that cow's milk would use. So on a crop level, many of those crops are actually not so bad, but quite often the local production practices are not very sustainable.
I mean, collectively, if we were all vegan, what impact would that have on the environment?
So we calculated that food-related greenhouse gas emissions could be reduced by roughly 3/4. What that would mean is if you put all those reductions together and you declared it a country, it would be the second largest emitter in the world, just after China. Double the emissions of all of the EU combined.
Gosh, I know veganuary is quite a thing this month, but let's be honest, the entire world is not about to go vegan. So I guess the next question is, as an individual, how much of an environmental impact will it have if I properly go vegan and stop eating those cheese and onion crisps?
Well, your personal carbon footprint would be somewhat related to the carbon footprint of the country you live in. So if on average, food-related emissions make up about 1/3 or 1/4 of your carbon footprint, then you can reduce your carbon footprint by 3/4 of that amount. So that is already a big thing. If you put that together with, for example, flying a bit less and changing your energy provider to a renewable energy provider, you can really, on a personal level, make dramatic changes. And it's not only that. Through your personal actions, you provide an example that takes the fear maybe of change away from others, that shows that it's actually possible. And in the end, what would be a good outcome is that if on some days it's normal to have a completely plant-based diet. So in one research project, we found that a flexitarian diet with very moderate amounts of animal source foods, like one serving of red meat per week, could indeed avoid dangerous levels of climate change if we combine it with technological changes, reductions in food loss and waste and such.
Okay, so that's individuals. But if you're a policymaker, what can you do with that information?
There are lots of things that have to be done. So what we look in our research is how do dietary guidelines contribute to healthy and sustainable diets? How does the legislation that is used in the agricultural system contribute to a sustainable food system? How do prices contribute to an environment where healthy and sustainable foods are actually affordable? And on all of those, we found there are major barriers. For example, our dietary guidelines are at the moment don't really include much in terms of sustainability. If we think about prices, at the moment, we don't pay for the climate damages in the price of foods. We don't pay for the health costs that are associated with, for example, overconsumption of red and processed meat. In our studies, we calculated that if we were to include those costs, beef would be easily 40% more expensive, dairy 20% more expensive. If we included the health costs for processed meat here, it would be double its price. Then lots of people say, oh, but you must not tinker with food prices and that's bad for poor households. But actually, you want that people react to those price changes. You don't want people, no matter if they are wealthy or not wealthy, to consume those detrimental products.
But it's not quite as easy as you say. Sure, vegetables are cheaper than meat, but we now have a lot of specialist vegan food. In fact, 1/4 of all new UK food products last year were labelled vegan. Some of these meat substitutes are quite expensive. And aren't they quite processed too?
Yeah, they're very processed. They usually run some kind of plant-based substance through shearing machines by which they introduce the texture of meat into that product. And that is, yeah, exactly. Sounds delicious, right? And that is very energy intensive. So usually those products, whilst they still have less emissions than beef and less emissions than many other animal products, they usually have about 5 times the emissions of an unprocessed legume. And at the same time, they still keep with the current fast food, junk food paradigm. So if you eat a Western diet and you just make the products vegan, you're probably a bit healthier and a bit lower in emissions. But from any public health perspective, it wouldn't be considered a healthy diet.
So basically, it's not okay to go vegan. I've got to go unprocessed vegan.
Yeah, if you do it for your own health, then you should make sure you eat a healthy diet.
Oh my God, it's so hard. We have seen a fourfold increase in the number of people who consider themselves vegans here in the UK in the last year. But is it a fad? Or do you think that in 50 years from now, people are going to be laughing at the idea of all those Sunday roasts that people were eating up every week in 2020?
I don't think it's a fad, because from every perspective that you look at, predominantly plant-based diet, whether it's completely vegan or almost vegan, would always come out as one of the good things that should be part of the solution. We know vegan diets even probably amongst the healthiest. We know from an environmental perspective, from a climate change perspective for sure, it's the one with the lowest emissions. I mean, we need massive changes in the agricultural system that goes along with changes in demand. But those can be done without hopefully getting any farmer out of business. I mean, usually the horticulture sector has quite a high profit margin and needs a little bit more labor. So there might be even more people needing to work on farms than before in a completely plant-based agricultural system.
One final question. What are you making for dinner tonight?
Oh, I don't know yet, actually. Probably some kale, kidney beans with brown rice, and a bit of ginger, maybe soy sauce, chili, something like that.
Sounds great. Marco, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That was Marco Springman, senior researcher in population health at the University of Oxford, who's left me not quite sure what I'm going to have for dinner tonight. Coming up, Jeff Bezos, the Saudi Crown Prince, and a cracking Guardian exclusive. Now, how careful are you on WhatsApp? Would that change if you were the richest person in the world? The Guardian's UK technology editor, Alex Hearn, reveals how a hack like this could be possible.
You receive a text message from the number of someone you know. It has a link and a plausible description, or even simply contains a video. You open the message and that's it. Your phone's been hacked. You don't have to be an idiot to get hacked. Anyone could fall for that, and the person who fell for it this time was Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world. The quirk for Bezos is where the message came from. It wasn't a spook at some security service somewhere who had finagled his way into Bezos's inner circle over months or years of hard work. It came from a number belonging to Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto head of state of Saudi Arabia, who Bezos had met earlier in a dinner in LA. The two had exchanged phone numbers, and then this message arrives. And within hours, according to UN report, data was exfiltrated, lifted from Bezos's phone at a rate 30,000% faster than data had been leaving it before. For me, as a tech reporter, the thing I find interesting is that every single time we see one of these attacks deployed, it is notable. Some types of hacks are used in a sort of spray and pray approach. You fire them out hundreds of thousands of times and you see who you can get, and you take advantage of the fact that some people don't update their software, some people run things in an insecure fashion. This is the exact opposite. It is only ever targeted. To give you a sense of how rare these are and how valuable they are, finding a zero-click WhatsApp remote code exploitation that lets you run code on someone else's phone by simply sending them a message on WhatsApp can be sold on the open market today for $1.5 million. The political implications here are fascinating. On the one end, there's sort of an understanding in diplomatic circles that for all the shady business your underlings and your intelligence agencies might be getting up to, if you go and meet the head of a country, they're not going to try and slip a bug in your handbag while you have a face-to-face. This upsets those assumptions. If someone using MBS's number did this to Jeff Bezos, who else did they do it to? Did they use this on any one of the 80 heads of states and celebrities he met on his world tour to boost Saudi Arabia's image? We don't know. And then at the other side of things, there's the fact that information that may well have been obtained from this hack has taken on ever greater political importance. The beginning of this whole affair was when the National Enquirer, a tabloid publication in America that is strongly allied with Donald Trump, broke the news that Jeff Bezos was having an extramarital affair. The National Enquirer insists that it received that information through the estranged brother of the woman Bezos was having the affair with, but Bezos always suspected otherwise, and this news suggests he was right to, that perhaps the information was instead received directly from his phone and then leaked in the Saudis' case because of the links between Bezos and the Washington Post, a paper he owns in a personal capacity, that employed the Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered in the Saudi Arabian embassy in October 2018. This shows the way technology is, in some ways, a leveler. Once upon a time, the most powerful people in the world communicated in ways that were fundamentally different from normal people. But now, Jeff Bezos is using an iOS or an Android phone. He's texting on WhatsApp. The security vulnerabilities that he faces are exactly the same security vulnerabilities that I face as a journalist or that anyone faces out on the street. And that does give some hope. It means that the most powerful people in the world, in trying to improve security for themselves, will help the rest of us as well.
That was Alex Hearn. Get online now and read more on this story. That's it for today. My thanks to Marco Springman and Alex Hearn. This episode was produced by Mithali Rao, Rose Della Rabiti, and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.